Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. This hour, we're speaking with two African-American journalists about covering Black Lives Matter as part of an overwhelmingly white reporter cohort.
Racism is not a both sides issue. And what I mean by that is I really hope that this is the start of journalists and newsrooms across the country really examining what we mean when we say objectivity.
That's coming up in the second half of the show. But first, more of Michigan's businesses are beginning to reopen. Maybe it's a good idea to recap who's doing what. Restaurants and bars all over the state now have the option of resuming dine-in service with some limitations and protections for staff. If you go outside, you might actually hear the crack of a bat because amateur sports teams can get back to practicing as long as they do so outside. House cleaners are allowed to resume their jobs, although one can only imagine what they're going to find when they do. Drive-in movies can be open for business. Movie houses and cineplexes are open up north. However, most people still have to watch Netflix at home. And salons and barbers still closed for just a few more days. You have so many more options to go out and get things done right now. But that's going to mean many workers putting themselves out there. While infection rates have plummeted, the COVID-19 pandemic is still very much happening. Some workers are scared to get that email or phone call from the boss saying, "We can't keep paying your unemployment if you don't come back to work now." Gabrielle Bussell is a bartender at Arbor Brewing Company in downtown Ann Arbor. That is to say, she was, until the pandemic drove her into unemployment and ultimately closed the location she worked at. Gabrielle, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me and for letting me talk about our issues as service industry workers right now.
So what were your initial thoughts when the governor announced that bars and restaurants could reopen?
I think more than anything, I was pretty shocked. I think a lot of people were. I mean, just the fact that it happened a week earlier than what it sounded like it was going to be intended. And really, in that sense, giving people a lot less time to prepare for reopening and the safety guidelines that need to be followed. And I was honestly, I mean, beyond that, on a personal note, quite terrified that we would be reopening so soon. And I think a lot of service industry workers are feeling the same way right now, going back to work. I don't think anybody anticipated such an early announcement like that.
For those who haven't had the pleasure, could you explain what your work environment is like, I guess, in terms of population density?
Well, so I'm laid off of work right now, and I was employed at the Ann Arbor location for Arbor Brewing Company. But when I was there, I mean, we would see all types of customers come through, whether that was townies, whether that was, you know, when the students are in town, college students. We see a lot of people coming into town traveling for medical reasons. A lot of people from the U of M hospital end up coming through town.
What about in terms of your personal space while you're working?
So I would say as a bartender, especially at the pub that I was working at, there definitely was a decent amount of space between people as you're behind the bar. But ultimately, especially if you're a server, having some sort of distance between yourself and customers can be pretty difficult. And I mean, especially as a bartender, a server, a manager, anybody in this sort of environment, especially in the front of house, I mean, we often have to deal with drunk and disorderly customers and people who want to get up in your face. And it can be very challenging. And I can imagine especially challenging now, despite these guidelines that have been put into place.
Yeah. Have you been asked to go back to work?
So initially we were kind of getting asked like, "Oh, are you thinking about coming back to work?" And my answer was more or less, not really, but maybe depending on, you know, how things go and when the reopen happens. And then we got the news of the pub closing down. And since then, they've offered positions for us at the other locations, but they've made it clear that if we don't feel comfortable returning to work just yet, that they were fine with that and that they would allow us to retain our unemployment for the time being. But I definitely can speak to the fact that, you know, other people in the group that I've spoken with have said that they've been given the ultimatum by their employers, you know, as to whether or not they want to come back to work. If they don't want to come back to work, yeah, they're not going to be able to retain their benefits in the meantime.
Well, what have you been told about what safety procedures will be in place for those who do come back?
Personally, from our company, we got an email with a list of all the different procedures that they'll be taking up, and they're all very much in line with what those guidelines have been, as far as, you know, keeping tables, you know, 6 feet apart, and employees wearing masks and that sort of thing, the standard sort of stuff for that. Hmm.
You started a Facebook group that's grown to 2,500 people who work in the service industry.
Yeah.
What are you hearing from people about their concerns or just, you know, whether or not they're actually going back to work?
Right. So I took a poll on the page, and the majority of people said that they're not ready to go back. They don't feel comfortable. You know, the second sort of most amount of people said that they had concerns. They had mixed feelings about it. And very few people actually said that they were absolutely ready to come back to work. You know, some people are immunocompromised, or they are caring for people who are immunocompromised, or they have children. And luckily, we did find out that they can get a doctor's note and have the opportunity to stay home and collect unemployment in the meantime. But beyond that, I mean, for example, one person that I know told me that, you know, her husband has cancer, and she was able to get a doctor's note and stay home, but essentially has been given an ultimatum with a position that she had, and being told that since she isn't going to be able to come in, I mean, them being very understanding about her situation, but saying, look, like, sorry, but you can't keep this position, which is a position that happened to be the most lucrative one for her. And I'm hearing a lot of people saying, you know, we can't trust our employers to follow these guidelines, and we can't, you know, we don't trust that, you know, even if we report them, that something's going to be done about this. I mean, the service industry just generally is not known for being kind to its workers. Just overall, I think there are great business owners who have their workers' concerns in mind, you know, locally and otherwise. But yeah, a lot of people are not feeling so great about all of this, just generally.
Gabby, one thing that we've heard from a couple of different people, from public officials and even some in the medical profession, is that COVID-19 is just going to be a reality for the time being. I guess I wonder if that is the case, is it possible, or do you worry about the service industry being something that people can only do for work if they are young and healthy and don't have dependents? Or that it might become the kind of job that people go to when they don't have any choice, when they really do have to work?
You know, I definitely think these are concerns to think about. I think, you know, this unfortunately will be a time where a lot of employers will say, you know, oh, you know, we don't want to, you know, continue supporting people who, you know, can't come back to work for these reasons. You know, I think the face of the service industry just generally is going to change very, very much after all of this, during it, and, you know, quote unquote, after all of this. And I'm hoping that, you know, it doesn't get to the case that people, you know, only quote unquote young, healthy people will be working this, because there are many, many people who've been working in this industry for a long time, from a variety of ages, with a variety of situations at home, with family, with children, and with a variety of conditions, that are more than capable of doing the job. But I think that there needs to be a lot more put into place, not just for the workers, but for the general health of the public as well.
Yeah. You've started a petition to extend the closure for Washtenaw County. What are you calling for?
So, in this petition, we're asking that the closure of dine-in services and restaurants and bars be extended in Washtenaw County, and we're calling on the Board of Commissioners to grant this. And sort of as a secondary part, we're asking that if people are forced to work in these establishments, that they be provided with health care and hazard pay.
Have you heard anything about it?
So we have 650 signatures so far, and I've heard more often than not positive responses, people saying, yes, this is a huge concern, not just for workers, but for the community. And I've heard a little bit of pushback. I mean, I imagine that, you know, small business owners, you know, the ones that are able to right now are very gung-ho about reopening. And they, you know, I understand that small businesses have been suffering right now too. And I definitely feel for them, you know, pretty much what we say in the petition, that despite these government regulations for safety and health in restaurants and bars, I mean, customers cannot wear masks when they're eating and drinking. Drunk and difficult customers are not going to be easy to control, and they're not going to be very likely to follow these guidelines. And then on top of that, I mean, we're talking about the fact that experts have shown that air conditioning systems in public buildings actually spread COVID droplets. And I think more importantly in all of this, looking at the data in states that have reopened restaurants and businesses overall, there have been spikes in deaths and cases for COVID-19. So, you know, we don't want to contribute to that death toll in the meantime. Not for people just to come and have dinner and beer, you know, at a bar or restaurant. It's not worth it.
Gabrielle Bussell is a bartender in Ann Arbor. Pre-COVID, you can find her at Arbor Brewing downtown. Gabby, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. The pandemic has made all of us so painfully aware of how much we need our communities, whether it's work friends or church friends or friend friends that you just haven't seen since the lockdown began. There's a Michigan artist collective called Earthwork Music, based up north, that has drawn strength from community for years. And in the middle of COVID-19, Earthwork Music relaunched on May 22nd with new music, videos, live streams, and more. Seth Bernard is one of the founders, and he joins us now. Seth, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you for having me, April.
For those who aren't in your area, can you tell us how far back Earthwork goes and sort of what sets it apart from other labels in terms of ethos?
Yes. So we started in 2001. It's a collective of musicians who have sort of aggregated and joined forces around a commitment to community building and social change. So in the early days when we started, a lot of the big labels were collapsing. And I had a vision for sort of a different way of musicians to be able to show up for community and support each other in the creation of music, and also sort of owning the idea that musicians create culture and that artists are a really vital part of creating the conditions in society that make a better future possible. And so over the last two decades, we have grown a bit and changed a bit. But really, it's kind of this marriage of a label of artists, you know, releasing music. And then also we have this other aspect that's, like I said, a little bit built more around building community and standing for change.
So as you said, the roots of Earthwork is really kind of based in the digital music revolution and the incredible loss of revenues that a lot of musicians were going through as durable music sales became less of a thing and touring and just being on the road all the time became more and more important in terms of artist incomes. How would you say the ties that have been formed by Earthwork over the years have served people who are involved in recent years, maybe before COVID-19 was a thing?
So we forged a lot of partnerships with different nonprofit organizations over the last 20 years. And we're a statewide collective and we have some members in different parts of the country and different parts of the world. But really, it came out of Earthwork Farm, which is where I was born and raised and which is where we have our annual harvest gathering. A lot of these community connections exist as a result of our mission, you know, to use music to raise awareness and to promote cultural healing and individual personal healing. So we work with groups like On the Ground, doing the Musical Ambassador Program internationally. We work with groups like Crosshatch, trying to build community resilience. And now these days, we have gone through this process of going inward and kind of going into the chrysalis and now reemerging with a rebranding, new mission, vision, and values, new artists, and working more with folks in Flint and Detroit and Toledo, for example.
Seth, so many musicians even ones that we tend to think of as relatively well-known, still maintain day jobs. You know, you may see them playing regional festivals. You may see a lot of their stuff getting shared on social media, but they may have to do work that pays the bills to facilitate the work that they find truly meaningful. What are you noticing about folks in the collective and how COVID has interrupted their regular work and that delicate balance that they're maintaining?
So we have a pretty wide variety of folks in the collective. Some folks have been able to pivot, like me, for example. I have a Patreon, and then I also work for Title Track, which is a nonprofit organization that I started, and that's part-time. And then I've been making a record in the midst of all of this, and I wasn't able to keep going into the studio, so I pivoted to making a whole different record that started when the pandemic escalated here at home on my 4-track. And so a lot of us are sort of figuring out what we can do. There have been artist aid channels and assistance. Some of us have filed for unemployment. And these online concerts have been great in terms of continuing to show up for community and feeling enthusiasm. It's interesting, though, doing these live streams because the rules are all different. You're alone in your house. There's nobody clapping. It's wonderful when people are talking to each other in the middle of your songs in the chats. And then we sort of are playing for tips again, like the early days.
Right.
But people have been showing that they value what we do a lot. And so with the launch of this store, we're in partnership with our longtime partners, Higher Grounds Trading Company. We've moved our inventory to their roastery, and they were one of Michigan's first fair trade companies and first B Corps. But they're doing order fulfillment for us. So as a collective, you know, we have a lot of new cool things, mugs and shirts and stickers. We're doing a weekly Earthrise session in partnership with Higher Grounds to just help people get grounded on Monday mornings. Again, just try to build community in the way that we can. But it has been challenging economically. Some of us are involved in sort of leveraging policy at the state and federal level. All of us are really involved in grassroots efforts. You know, we have partners in Flint and Detroit, like I said, who are really trying to lift up the most vulnerable. There's 10,000 households in Detroit who still don't have their water turned on, 5,000 in Flint. So working with folks like Monica Lewis Patrick with We the People of Detroit and Naira Sharif with Flint Rising is really important to us to sort of see where the need is and the people who are on the front lines doing the work and see how we can lift up their voices and support their efforts in solidarity.
You know, one of the things that I feel like I hear people say all the time now is that the pandemic has pulled back the curtain on how fragile our institutions are. And when they're saying that, sometimes they're talking about their jobs or realizing, you know, public education is really kind of a fragile balance that, mm-hmm. you know, lets parents work while their kids get educated. But I know things probably look a little bit different in your part of Michigan than they do in Southeast right now. But would you say that you're getting much of a sense of that in terms of the world that you and the other artists in Earthwork experience?
Absolutely. It is lifting the veil on how fragile things are and really who is showing up to help others. And so I think the rise of mutual aid networks has been a really eye-opening thing for people, recognizing that citizen governance has really held our communities together in a really tangible way.
What do you mean?
So there are these mutual aid networks around the state where people have just sprung into action as soon as the pandemic escalated and communicated and volunteered to support people in need. And it's all done without the exchange of money or business structure, but just basically having these networks of communication. There's one in Detroit that my colleague and friend Piper Carter is a part of called Southwest Cares. There's a Northwest Michigan Mutual Aid up here by me. And so it's really just people finding the gaps in what the community needs and filling them. And we've seen that in different sectors. Throughout my adult life, I've really seen the nonprofit sector fill in the gaps where government has failed or failed to show up.
Right.
And we see that in the private sector as well, people seeing where there's a need and filling it. But I do feel like it's kind of twofold, right? It's disappointing and scary in some ways, but it's also affirming of the power of community and the power of individuals and like collective efforts that are led from the ground up, the grassroots, to really make a change. I mentioned the water shutoffs before. It was an amazing grassroots effort, gaining the support of larger sort of big green organizations to leverage our governor to sign an executive order to end the shutoffs in the time of a pandemic, which is really important. And so I think some of these things that we've seen the veil lifted on, we have to continue to work to see things transform in a positive way. And there are many ways where I don't think we want things to go back to normal, because there are aspects of business as usual that were very harmful to people and to the planet. And as artists, we feel a sense of responsibility to lift up people's voices and to like find out where the efforts are that are working and that are necessary, and see what we can do to help bring music and bring people into them. And we're learning as we go. I think all of us are in this moment. So it's a time of uncertainty that brings us all together. And I've definitely learned a lot about myself and about what I want my future to look like in this great pause where I've been home and off the road for 2 months.
Well, tell me about something that is more clear to you now.
Thanks for asking, April. Well, I'm a parent myself. I have a six-year-old, and I've spent a lot of time with her. And we've spent a lot of time outside, a lot of time by the water, by the trees. And I've come into contact with how restorative it is for me to actually be with nature and to be at home, spend more time in reflection, and how that has been sort of this wellspring for my creative process, which is kind of at the center of my life. And so to not be rushing around from gig to gig and meeting to meeting has allowed me to find some personal healing and restoration that I really want to build more into how I work in the future. I just turned 40 on April 1st too. And I have done this thing, April, over the last couple of years where I have this spring-fed pond just down the hill from my house here. It's really cold year-round, and it stays open year-round. And when I launched the Clean Water Campaign, I made this commitment to do a cold water plunge at least once a month.
Oh.
And so now I'm doing it every day.
Oh.
And
how's that going for you?
It's going so well. And it's also this thing where it's like, you don't have to want to do it. You just have to do it every day. And I never regret it. I know that it's good for me. But it's also this practice of just doing the thing that you know is good for you, even if you don't feel like it.
Building character. Well, Seth Bernard, I hope your nervous system can handle this and the many other challenges coming at you in the weeks and months to come. And we really appreciate everything that you're doing. We're looking forward to hearing all the artists on Earth work real soon.
I really appreciate what you're doing, April. Thanks to everybody at Stateside and Michigan Radio for the great work that you do. And honored to be here with you today. All my best.
Seth Bernard is one of the founders of Earthwork Music, which relaunched last month with videos, music, new live streams for everybody listening at home. Arts and culture coverage on Stateside is supported in part by an award from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs.
Clear your mind to be here. The past is behind and the future will never be here. So plan your day and don't let your fears get in the way. Let love live. Let it show. Let it grow. Let it show. Let it grow.
In recent weeks, many of us have been glued to the news as protests against excessive use of police force against Black Americans have spread all over the country. The journalists reporting that news have been working hard. For Black journalists, the demands have been both professional and very personal. They're covering the deaths of people who look like themselves, members of their family. We wanted to take a few moments to consider how this work is being done and really who's doing it. Kat Stafford reports national stories on race and ethnicity for the Associated Press. Kat, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me back on.
Ken Coleman is a writer for Michigan Advance and the author of books such as Soul on Air, Blacks Who Helped Define Radio in Detroit. Ken Coleman, good to have you back too.
Good day. Thanks for having me.
Can I ask both of you, of all the news that we were seeing through the weekend, what struck you the most?
Well, there's no doubt. What's been extremely surprising, at least for this journalist who's been doing this stuff for 30 years, is the number of protests, not only in the city of Detroit proper, but they have now expanded to outer ring suburbs. They are in large part majority white. And that's something that I did not see 27 years ago when I was covering the Malice Green murder trial in Detroit. And so, you know, what I've seen in my lifetime compared to what I've seen over the last 10 days has been phenomenal.
Yeah. Kat, how about you?
I guess for me, seeing what I see as a culmination of many different things coming to head all at once. You're seeing the impact of COVID-19 on Black communities happening. You're seeing the economic fallout happening. And now we're dealing with the police brutality. But also what really caught my eye this weekend is this almost kind of reckoning that's happening within our own industry in terms of journalism. And a lot of people really saying, you know, Black journalists have been calling out these issues for years, for decades, and now people are finally listening to us. Finally, you're hearing our voices break through this ceiling that's been in place for so long, and there's so much frustration. So for me, I've been really watching all of that unfold, because really this is part of what's happening right now. You have to take a hard look at our coverage and how we have covered policing in Black communities over the years, how we've covered health disparities over the years in Black communities. All of that frustration is bubbling up right now, and that's what I've been paying attention to.
There was a survey from the Pew Research Center a couple years ago that found more than 75% of newsroom staff across America, 75% are white. How do you see that shaping the coverage of, I mean, I want to say things like the death of George Floyd, but also just the many ingredients in this perfect storm we're seeing right now. Kat, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I say this all the time, and I'm sure, you know, Ken has a lot of experience in this as well. I'm not shocked to see that people are feeling the way they feel right now, because when you have newsrooms that don't have not just diversity, I've kind of pushed back on that phrase. I prefer to call it representation, because that's what you really want to see in terms of who is in the newsrooms, who are making these decisions around coverage. When you don't have that representation, you are going to see stories that do not accurately represent what's happening in the moment. So when COVID-19 first started happening, when it became clear that Black people were being disproportionately impacted, so many of the stories, the coverage, were blaming these core morbidities instead of looking at how systemic racism and structural racism really led us to this point where Black folks are more likely to live in areas impacted by pollution, why Black people are more likely to live in food deserts, right? So when we look at this now police brutality issue, it's not surprising to see that there's so much anger directed toward the media, because we just have not been in these communities the way that we should have been.
One of the things that kind of surprised me over the weekend was there are a couple of stories across the nation in which Black journalists have been asked to step off the protest beat. Ken, what are we saying when we imply that Black journalists can't cover what's going on right now truthfully?
It's crazy. It's the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen in my life. And we live in a time where, you know, the most ridiculous thing that you've seen in your life changes every day. But look it, as I pointed out a little bit earlier, I broke into the business in the early 90s. And I'm old enough to have been a reporter during the Rodney King beating in Los Angeles in the early 90s, and the Malice Green fatal killing in Detroit in 1992. I remember being a rookie journalist in Detroit, and the National Association of Black Journalists were holding their national convention in Detroit. I vividly remember our souvenir booklet for the convention, and Gannett, that owned the Detroit News at the time, took out a back page, full color ad that had half column photos of the journalists. Just the journalists that worked at the Detroit News. The half-column photo took up the entire back color page of the souvenir booklet.
Oh, wow.
I've walked through the Detroit News and Detroit Free Press newsrooms in the last year, and not only have seen the dramatic reduction in the number of people who cover news, but disproportionately, it seems to me, the number of Black folk or people of color who are part of those news organizations. It's absolutely ridiculous to me for a news gathering agency of any semblance of respectability to omit or prevent an African-American journalist from covering what's going on today. It's the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen in my life, and I'm proud to work for a news site that values, as an African-American, values my point of view. And what's going on in Pittsburgh, what happened at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette is absolutely ridiculous to me.
For those who haven't seen the story, Alexis Johnson was the reporter at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette who was barred from protest coverage. But her cause was quickly picked up by journalists and others across the nation, suggesting that she was indeed, there was no one better to cover protests in her town. You know, it's great to hear that those conversations happen, but in newsrooms that aren't as diverse, you know, what's being asked of Black journalists if they are in mostly white environments and they're being asked to, you know, maybe take on a share of this that, you know, maybe puts them in typically dangerous positions? Kat, what do you see being asked of the African-American reporters that you know?
I'm glad that newsrooms are leaning on the expertise of Black reporters that do exist in these to be frank, white spaces, these white newsrooms. But I'm always cautious because I feel as if the onus should not solely be on the Black reporters, the Black staff in newsrooms to provide this perspective. At some point, at some level, our allies in the newsroom, other people in the newsroom are going to have to do the work and try to really immerse themselves in these communities to understand what's really happening, whether that's just working from, you know, I'm looking at Detroit specifically, working at a Narrow Way for a day, you know, really going out and meeting people, not just for a story, but just connecting with the community. We have to rebuild the trust that has been damaged by decades of journalists that really didn't do due diligence when it came to making those connections. And I had a conversation with my dad, who has lived in Detroit his entire life. He was in Detroit during the 67 riots uprising, and he just turned 80 this year. And we were talking about the media coverage of George Floyd, the protests and everything. And from his perspective, he feels as if the media once again is doing the same thing. You know, he was in his 20s when the rebellion happened in Detroit, and he just recalls how the story he felt was not told from a Black perspective. It was told through a very narrow white gaze. And, you know, just hearing my dad share these thoughts, it concerns me, and I'm worried that we're making the same mistakes again. Just looking at how there's been so much focus on the looting as opposed to why are these people in the streets? Where is this anger and frustration coming from? Those are the stories that should be focused on right now, right? So I'm just concerned that we're going to continuously make these same mistakes that we've made over the years.
Kat, what kinds of things are you considering when you're choosing the words that you use to write stories about protests and unrest? You know, there's been a lot of discussion in recent days over whether it's appropriate to call the destruction of property violent, or indeed who might be responsible for that.
That's a great question. I mean, you see, I just corrected myself when I said 67 riots, because I think we have to be very careful with how we phrase things. So I've been very cautious in my not just the language I'm using, but who are the voices that I am uplifting in my coverage right now. I had a story about Black women mayors who really in this moment are stepping up and leading some of these large cities that have had a lot of the protests that we're seeing across the country. And intentionality is what I'm trying to do, making sure the people that I am quoting have the expertise that can add an extra layer of nuance and understanding for readers. So for me, it's not even just the language that I use, but really who are the voices that are being amplified in this moment. That I can't think of anything that's more important than that when you're looking at COVID-19, when you're talking about police brutality.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Kat Stafford. She reports national stories on race and ethnicity for the Associated Press. And we're also talking with Ken Coleman. He's a writer from Michigan Advance. They're both based in Detroit. Ken, I feel like you were one of the first observers in my feed covering the protests in Detroit. observing that nightside protesters looked different than the dayside group. Could you say a little bit more about that and why you felt it was important to that people see what you saw?
No, I appreciate it. I live in a town that's 80% Black, and I've lived in this town for 52 years. And one of the things that Detroiters always sort of joke about with each other is, I mean, we're a big city, but we're really sort of a big town. And everybody kind of knows everybody. The activist community, you know, I know who those people are. And so what was immediately striking to me the first day was both really in the daytime and nighttime protests was it didn't look like Detroit to me. And I thought that was very interesting. In an 80% Black city, and a majority of the protesters were white. Now, on one end, as I reported, I thought that was very interesting and striking. And from a personal level, being so intimate with the city, I thought that was helpful. But the destructive nature, at least in the early couple of days in the evening, struck me as very odd. And after that, I'll be honest with you, as a, you know, from a personal standpoint, I was enraged. You know, what happens a lot of times in Michigan and happens in Detroit, there's a lot of back and forth about, you know, the Black city versus the out county suburbs. And I thought that there was an element, I wrote about it and tweeted about it, I thought there was an element of white privilege, quite frankly, that was being carried out by some of the protesters who happened to be white, particularly in the evening. Privilege, white privilege, what I mean by that is I'll come and march in your town if I want to and be violent and destructive if I want to, because after all, I'm white. And this African-American Detroiter, native Detroiter, was very, very upset about that.
Kat, are there stories and voices that you see still missing from coverage of the protests right now?
That's a great question. I think that's something that we should always be thinking about. And that's something that I've been kind of mulling over this weekend. You know, we've had all of the spot stories that we've been pushing out, but I feel like we're reaching that moment where journalists, we should really be taking a step back and trying to develop some bigger pieces to really dive into, again, the feelings, the emotions, that very valid feelings that communities have. You know, I had a story just yesterday looking at how there's a growing movement of people that are pushing for police departments across the nation to not just be defunded, but to dismantle them altogether. And a couple years ago, if someone would have said that, people would have said, oh, that's radical, that's nonsense. But what I'm hearing on the ground, there's a lot of movement around it, a lot of conversation about, is this possible? So when I think about stories to pay attention to, that comes to the top of mind. What also comes to the top of mind is 2020. How are people feeling about this? Is this going to impact voter turnout? One person that I spoke with, an activist in Minnesota, she basically said she does not participate in this political system. She does not see Black folks' liberation through the electoral process as it stands. And for me, that's truly stunning. And I think we need to pay attention to this momentum on the ground as we're starting to hear more feelings of people about how they're feeling about Trump, President Trump, Joe Biden, and other issues as well.
If I could say, I mean, I think that Kat hit that spot on. I mean, I get up every morning and post 5 or 10 things, notable achievements that have happened centering on Black America or, you know, related to Black America. You know, what I found in my nearly 30 years of reporting and analysis is that white folk pay attention to Black folk when it's February or in times of crisis.
Black History
Outside
Month.
Of that,
right.
they don't, Black folk don't even exist. So, I mean, I think what needs to happen is just what Kat's talking about, but we need to do it 24/7, 365 days a year, and not wait for February or times of crisis to recognize Black folk, and I extend that to brown folk and others as well, who happen to be, quote, minorities in America. That's the way forward.
A lot of mental health professionals have been recommending that folks take a break from the news every once in a while. But as Kat alluded to, this is a very difficult time in which to be doing that. How do you both take care of yourself when you have to be covering these events? Kat, how's that working for you? What do you try to work in to keep yourself sane?
Well, first, I try to make sure that my circle is tight. And what I mean by that is that I have mentors to lean on. I have other Black journalists, as well as some journalists of color, who I could lean on and just share some raw thoughts with them, thoughts that you can't exactly share on social media, right? So that first step is important. And also just finding small moments to breathe. It's easy to become overwhelmed. But for me, I have also found strength in this moment because I feel as if there is not a single topic that I would rather be covering in this moment right now than race in America. I can't think of anything that's more important to cover in this moment than race in America. So for me, just knowing that the stories that I and others are reporting and publishing in this moment, that they are helping bring perspective, much needed perspective and truth to this moment, for me, that motivates me to keep pushing forward. But I will say I'm looking forward to after November, where I could actually take a week off.
frequent listeners to the show will remember this is kind of a new job for you, Kat. I mean, I cannot think of a more auspicious entry onto a what turned out to be one of the breaking news stories of the year.
Yeah, you know, I hit the campaign trail in March and then COVID-19 hit. So it's just been a crazy time to start a new role. But again, I couldn't imagine anything else I would rather be covering in this moment.
Ken, how are you taking care of yourself?
I do a lot of reading and research, and I've always done that. I'm reading a lot about the 50s and the 60s. I'm reading a lot about particularly 1966, 1967, 1968 in America, because there's so many parallels that are being drawn to what's happening here in 2020 to those particular 3 years. And I'm finding some similarities and some differences. But secondly, in addition to that, I'm a runner. I run 2 miles every day. It's a little bit tougher to run it with PPE on and a mask and gloves. But I'm very serious about social distancing, even in covering these protests. I'm very much concerned about what these protests might yield in 2 or 3 months with related to COVID spread. But the running is therapeutic. It helps me, and obviously, to try to be as physically fit as I can, but it also helps me to think. And so reading and researching about events 50 years ago and getting out and running 2 miles is how I get through it.
As we've said several times today, the deaths of unarmed Black people at the hands of police is not something new. We don't know what's going to happen this time around, but there's been a lot of conversation through the weekend about, you know, again, some of these issues like why is this happening now? What is the confluence of events over the past decade that got us here? As we finish up, I wanted to ask you both what the role of journalism is after the big displays. Not to suggest, I mean, it doesn't feel like things are exactly slowing down, but I don't know. Ken, how do you answer that question?
Well, I think, again, we have to be consistent. I mean, journalism is like a lot of industry in America. It's copycat. It's what's hot now. It's what's trending. I think we have to cover people of color, Blacks, Browns, and others, every day moving forward, the way that we're covering them now. And again, I'd point out that, you know, I've been in the business 30 years, and I've seen a couple different cycles. And I've seen where this stuff has been hot and sexy. I've seen where newsrooms have ramped up and hired 2 or 3 more Black people or brown people based on what they see the 6 month or 1 year trend. But what's going to happen if these protests dissipate? And that's the major thing for me. We need to stay consistent. This is a country that's becoming browner. Blacker and browner every day of the week. And will the journalism community rise to the occasion and represent that continually is my ask and what I believe their charge should be.
Kat, what do you say?
Well, for starters, just this morning I tweeted, racism is not a both sides issue. And what I mean by that is I really hope that this is the start of journalists in newsrooms across the country really examining what we mean when we say objectivity. Because I think we need to start not just there. I think we also need to take a look at when you do have Black folks in the newsroom and you do have journalists of color in the newsroom, what are their assignments? What are they covering? It's not enough to just hire us. We need to be given opportunities to ascend into these management roles, to help guide coverage decisions. And I hope, going along the lines of what Ken said, that this doesn't disappear. We need to be intentional about who we're interviewing, the stories that we cover, because, you know, people are being caught off guard right now. People are shocked about the outrage. But I say, if you are in these communities, if you are doing the due diligence in terms of building connections and talking to folks on the ground, you would not be that surprised to see people in the streets protesting. So I think we need to take a hard look at the industry that we are in and not just form diversity and inclusion committees to look at the problem. We know what the problem is. What is the tangible action we're going to take? That's what I want to see.
Kat, that's a really interesting point you raise about how racism is covered. It feels like it's really informed by politics coverage, which says, you know, which tends to cast things in the role of, well, some people believe this way and other people believe this way. But what are other models that come to your mind when we think about how we cast racism and institutional racism?
So I interviewed an expert. Her name is Rihanna Anderson. She is an assistant professor at the University of Michigan who studies racism and how it pretty much intersects with public health. And she told me that it is past time for America to consider racism a public health hazard. It is time to consider police brutality that Black and brown people experience at the hands of police as a public health hazard. Only then, she believes, will we start to see some real coalition behind this notion that it is not just an isolated event that occurs. Racism is deeply embedded in the fabric of this nation, and I don't think that is something that we have truly begin to reckon with. So until we have that honest conversation as a nation, looking at how racism has deeply impacted Black Americans, how it has led to a lot of these oppressive institutions that we have, we will never truly solve it.
It almost sounds like, I hesitate to mention because scientific model has not always done right by communities of color, but it almost sounds like we just need to be more scientific about it.
I think so. And it's a complicated topic, but it's also not as complicated as people make it. Racism is bad. Racism is not a both sides issue. And until people truly understand that and get behind that, I feel as if we're going to keep having the same conversations over and over again. We're going to continuously see these crises impacting Black folks, whether it's the Great Recession, whether it's Hurricane Katrina. You can go down the list and look at all of these recent crises that have occurred in America and who has been hit the hardest. It shows us that we have yet to deal with racism in this country.
Kat Stafford reports for the Associated Press covering issues on race and ethnicity. We've also been talking with Michigan Advance writer Ken Coleman. He's also a published author on several books addressing history and Detroit history. Ken, Kat, please stay safe out there. We really, really appreciate the work that you're doing right now.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks so much for listening. We'll catch you tomorrow.